select cities.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. One of the nation's sharpest social critics will join us in a moment. Chris Hedges will be here to talk about his new book, America, the Farewell Tour. But first, four listener comments about the last few shows. Here's what several listeners had to say, including our show yesterday, in which we were talking about President Trump and the fallout from the Manafort and Cohen convictions.
I want to tell you about the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I voted for Donald Trump. I sincerely regret it now. I've been following the stories about him closely, and to me it's obvious that he is in the back pocket of the Russian mob. The Russian mob has invaded the Oval Office. I believe Donald Trump is a traitor to this country, and I'm shocked and dismayed at people that are still continuing to support him. I know it's painful to admit when you make a mistake, but it's time for a lot of people to stand up and say, you know what? I made a mistake. The president is a traitor. Thank you.
This is Dave in Tampa. Regarding your interview with the author who wrote the book about Trump and his Russian mob connections, I want to say I think this is why the Democratic leadership in Congress should be on the warpath for impeachment right away. We already have enough on the record between the emoluments clause and what his personal attorney has said about conspiring to break campaign finance law. There's already enough there to impeach this man. And meanwhile, you have an investigation run by Robert Mueller that probably is going or is gradually uncovering some sort of international conspiracy to defraud the United States. Meanwhile, you've got probably the center of that investigation, somebody who's directly involved in a unique position to pardon the criminals involved in it and to disrupt the investigation itself. That is unacceptable. You cannot allow that to happen. And what needs to be done, and the Democrats need to step up to it and make it the point of this election, in my opinion, is this man has to be removed from office, and that Mueller investigation needs to go forward as a criminal investigation. And when that's done, assuming he finds evidence and takes it to court and they're convicted, the people involved, if they are convicted, need to go to prison, including Donald Trump. They should not be pardoned by someone who's directly involved. And the longer he sits in office, the more ability he has to do that and even preempt prosecution with pardons.
The attitude of the Fox commentators on that clip you played on Thursday, I wonder how many of them would have the same reaction if it was their daughter, niece, sister, granddaughter that was paid off by Trump to keep quiet about having slept with him. Would they be boasting about it, or would they have the same indignation they had over the Lewinsky-Clinton case? Richard St. Petersburg.
This is Gary from Dunedin. That was absolutely hilarious yesterday when that Trumpy Fox News brainwashed guy called in, and you caught him repeating the exact talking points from Hannity. And then when you asked him if he watched Fox News and Hannity, he said no. And then when you told him that those talking points were exactly coming from Hannity's mouth, and did he watch Hannity, he said yes. Then he said quickly, no. That was just perfect, man. I mean, these guys are like liars, but they can't keep their lies consistent.
Well, those are some of the listener comments that came in over the last couple of days. In his new book, America, the Farewell Tour, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Chris Hedges looks at a country in decline and talks about how we got here and how it paved the way for the election of Donald Trump. In the book, he visits a decaying factory town, meets prostitutes, visits sex clubs, talks with neo-fascist groups, and explores the exploding number of opiate deaths in the U.S., all signs, he says, of a country in decline and signs that the rich are winning the class war. And Chris Hedges joins us live right now on the phone. Chris, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Is it as bad as I said there, or is it worse?
It is as bad, and it's not reported on very much. The major networks function as more as courtiers in the centers of power, transmitting the latest gossip and trivia and speculation about will Jeff Sessions get fired or not get fired, or what does Michael Cohen have, or et cetera. Meanwhile, for at least half of this country, probably more, they are living in severe distress. and there is just an acceleration of the pillage on the part of corporate power. We see it with the latest tax cut. We are told that because the stock market is having a tremendous run, the economy is doing very well. What we're not told is that it's having a tremendous run because these corporations have bought back their own stock, which swells the compensation packages of CEOs and senior corporate managers. And the longer we fail to deal with the with social inequality that at this point replicates, in fact, has passed the Gilded Age, the more these pathologies, what sociologists call diseases of despair, will proliferate. And that was really what I went to, was to, and you're right, I was with heroin addicts and BDSM cultists in San Francisco and survivalists and preppers in Utah and people in the old, who had worked in the old GM plants. Of course, GM, after NAFTA, moved to Monterrey, Mexico, where they pay Mexicans $3 an hour, and cities like Anderson, Indiana, have turned into deindustrialized wastelands, hardly unique throughout the country, with all of the attendant problems that come with the collapse of community, loss of income, loss of self-worth, loss of dignity. And we're not addressing, we're not even bringing up those problems. We're blaming the rise of Trump on Russia, and the longer we ignore what's happening within our country, the more dysfunctional our political system will become, and the more these pathologies, including, as you mentioned, the white hate groups I was with, Knights of the Alt-Right, Proud Boys, Three Percenters, will embody the national zeitgeist.
I think President Trump supporters, though, would say that he hit a home run with the economy. They would say, well, look, we saw AT&T and Walmart give out some bonuses right after the tax cut was passed. As you said, Wall Street's going well. But on the other hand, so is unemployment. Unemployment's going well. The president would say for African Americans that it's an historic low. That's what his supporters would say. What would you say back?
Well, I would first of all say that the economy, that, you know, whatever, those bonuses were kind of almost a public relations gimmick. We know that wages have not risen, that there has not been significant hiring of new workers. But more importantly, since 2008, the increase in jobs or the new jobs that have been created have been temporary jobs, part of the gig economy, without benefits. No stability, no job protection. That's the first point I would make. The second point is that they have, and this isn't something Trump did. It's been with us for a while, but they fixed the unemployment statistics so that if you stop looking for work, you're not counted as unemployed. If you work an hour a week, you are counted as employed. If you work 28 hours a week, which is what the average worker in Walmart works, even though you're still below the poverty line, you're counted as employed. So I think that they have managed to reconfigure statistics to essentially mask the economic deprivation that afflicts huge numbers of American families. And a few years ago, the Los Angeles Times did a story where they went through all of the issues that I just cited and others, and estimated that real unemployment, i.e. including the working poor, people who live below the poverty line, is probably about 17%.
We're talking with Chris Hedges about his new book, America, The Farewell Tour. Chris is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He's written several great books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and this is 88.5 FM. Chris, you went to several towns that have been deindustrialized, and two towns, Anderson, Indiana, and Scranton, Pennsylvania, really jump out. Your portrait of Scranton is really stark. Tell us what's going on in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and tell us where Scranton was maybe 100 years ago.
Well, Scranton, like many of these former and deindustrialized cities, was a manufacturing powerhouse, certainly a century ago. What we've seen, and Scranton is just a template for most major manufacturing centers, is a city in freefall. So that when I got to Scranton, they were on the city was on the cusp of declaring bankruptcy and was furiously selling off its assets. All public employees had had their salaries reduced to minimum wage, including the mayor. They eventually did sell off their sewer system, their parking authority, and electricity. I mean, all the kind of public utilities that come with a functioning, healthy urban environment, to private corporations who, of course, immediately jacked up the price. But the question is, what happens when they don't have any assets to sell? And what they're trying to do is fill a huge decline in tax revenues because people don't have any money. So what they're collecting out of the city is increasingly diminished. And then they were also hurt. Their city bonds, their pension funds were crushed in 2008. I think they lost up to 40%. Again, not unique. And so it was just a portrait of how the victims of the financial fraud that was carried out by Wall Street are the ones who pay the price. Meanwhile, the criminals, the people who carried out fraud, are given, in essence, no-interest loans to reinflate the economic bubble that got us into trouble in the first place. And what we're seeing now throughout the economy is that they're not taking this money and investing it. They didn't take the money from the tax cuts to invest it in manufacturing, to create good jobs. But they use it to gamble. They use it to inflict debt peonage. That's how they extract money. I mean, because the loans may be at almost 0%, but they have to be repaid. So that's where you get this insane student debt, $1.4 trillion. That's where you get the horrible policies of credit card companies, so that if you're late on your credit card, you're suddenly paying 28%. That's where you get the rising health care costs, even if you have insurance. Co-payments, you know, services not covered keep climbing. The cost of insurance keeps climbing. So they extract this money in programs of austerity and in programs of debt peonage from a public that has less and less and less. And that's just not going to come to a good end. I think most economists acknowledge that we're headed for another crash. There are many economists, Richard Wolff, Michael Hudson, Naomi Prinz, and others, who will argue that this crash will be far worse than 2008 because the financial sector doesn't have a plan B. They can't lower interest rates any more than they've already been lowered. So it's number one, not a sustainable system, and number two, it's a system that keeps extracting more and more pounds of flesh from an American public that has less and less to give. And coupled with that is a kind of revoking of our basic civil liberties, including due process. Then you have militarized police, which in urban deindustrialized areas are shooting unarmed citizens 3.3 on average a day. Mass incarceration, 25% of the world's prison population, although we are only 5% of the world's population, as a form of social control. Wholesale surveillance, we're the most monitored, watch, eavesdropped, photographed population in human history. And I covered, as a reporter, the former Stasi state in East Germany. All of these things are extremely worrying, and they are exhibited in forms of behavior fueled by psychological and emotional distress that I chronicle in my book.
We're talking with Chris Hedges. The book is America, the Farewell Tour. So, Chris, you point out, and you're right, and I didn't know this, that because of the mining and the steel in Scranton, Pennsylvania, 100 years ago, they had the second highest per capita income in the entire country. That's an amazing statistic, yeah, given the downfall of Scranton today. But I think people that would be critical of you would say, well, you know, people need to start new businesses. What happens when people try to start businesses, new businesses in Scranton?
Well, we know. You know, there's three forms, roughly, of capitalism. So there's the penny capitalism of the farmers. I grew up in a farm town. They bring their produce in and sell it. Then there's what we can call regional capitalism. These are local business owners who run a small business, who sit on the school board, who pay taxes, who live in the community, and who hire workers. And then there's corporate capitalism, which is supranational. It has no loyalty to the nation state. It hoards its profits overseas. It crushes. You go to any small town, including the towns where I grew up, and the main streets are empty shops, and there's a giant Walmart where workers are paid. Walmart is the great union-busting corporation of America, so there's no job protection. Workers are paid, very substandard wages, and, of course, products are made in China, where people are replicating what is close to slave labor, and the money is extracted from the community. So the Walton family, each member of the Walton family, I read, makes an average of $11,000 an hour, and they're not even working. They're just accruing profit. So I think that when we hear this call, which many people on the right will hold up, that we have to be an entrepreneurial society, although liberal, self-identified liberal columnists like Thomas Friedman say the same thing, we don't understand that the game is fixed. And Matt Taibbi wrote a very good book about it called Divide, where he said, in essence, it's basically a two-tiered legal system. You have corporate lobbyists who write the laws and the regulations to fix the system, rig the system in their favor, and the rest of us who don't have armies of lawyers and lobbyists are essentially punished. And so that reconfiguration of the legal system is one that works in the favor of these corporations and further kind of ties our hands and binds our feet and makes it extremely difficult for us to escape the predatory activity of the corporate of these corporate monstrosities.
You're right about people who try to start bookstores in some of these cities or coffee shops, and the business lasts for a couple of years and then it dies because there's just not the economy to support those kind of enterprises.
Well, but it's also Amazon.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're that big, I mean, ask any bookseller.
Yeah.
They undersell you and drive you out.
We're getting a lot of emails and a lot of phone calls, and I don't know if you've got more time, but it's 11:23, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, is with us. We're talking about his new book, America, The Farewell Tour. Do you think the opiate addiction crisis is linked to the decline of the economy?
Yes, because what was interesting, and I have a chapter on gambling that was written out of the Trump Taj Mahal before it closed, is that all of these activities are anesthetize people. They make them numb. They help them cope with distress and anxiety and pain. And that's what an opioid like heroin does. First of all, we've seen corporations like primarily Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family push this stuff onto the American public with a false advertising campaign. Oxycontin is a heroin derivative, telling doctors that it's a safe pain relief medication that's not addictive. All of this was untrue. There's a good book on this, Dreamland. And then what happens is their pill habit becomes so expensive that they switch to heroin, which is cheap, $6 a bag. Heroin by these pushers is often laced with fentanyl, and that is one of the primary reasons that we have such 72,000 overdoses, deaths. That doesn't even count the people who don't die. But I think, yes, people are just so in such psychic and emotional, and I would argue even physical pain, that they're looking to check out. And there are lots of ways to do it in this society. But again, that is emblematic of a society that has failed its citizenry and is not responding to the very real distress that grips at least half the American public.
Chris, but if you and I, if you came down here to Tampa, and I know you've been to Mockley, and we can maybe get to that a little bit later on, but if you came down to Florida, you would find really wealthy communities. Some communities were whole neighborhoods that used to be middle class. Houses are now selling for $1 million. If you go to the airports these days, they're filled with people. There's a record number of people flying for business and for pleasure. There are some people, despite what you're talking about, you know, the decline of some of these cities, like the industrial Northeast and Midwest, there are some places that are booming around the country, and people would say to you, well, I don't recognize the America you're talking about.
Well, of course there are pockets of affluence. I live in one, Princeton, New Jersey. Manhattan is one. San Francisco is another. But having spent 20 years overseas, much of that in the developing world, what you're replicating is the imbalance that is often common to developing countries. So, for instance, I lived in Lima, Peru, in a neighborhood called Miraflores, which looks like Miami, with the exception that they have high walls and razor wire on the top of the walls. You can walk 10 blocks away, and people are literally camped out living next to open sewers. That's what we're replicating. It's the destruction of the middle class, and in particular the working middle class. Working class that in the 1950s, roughly 36% were union members, were able to make decent incomes, buy a home on a single salary, have medical benefits, pensions, job protection, send their kids to college. That has vanished.
You know,
and it's been replaced by an upper echelon that has accrued wealth that has not been seen in this country for probably a century. And then, of course, you have a small, thin ribbon of managers. You know, these are lawyers, accountants, professionals who serve this oligarchic system. But you can't maintain a democracy within an oligarchy. That is not a new idea. Aristotle wrote about it. I mean, Aristotle said when there are those kinds of economic distortions, then you only have two routes, and that's either tyranny, which we are moving towards very rapidly towards a kind of corporate tyranny, or revolution.
I want to ask you about the election, President Trump and Hillary Clinton. President Trump, would you characterize Trump voters as working class people or people that are affected by this deindustrialization that you're talking about? Or how would you characterize Trump voters?
Yes. So, for instance, when I was in Anderson, Indiana, now all these GM plants, the 25,000 jobs are gone. In many cases, they just bulldoze. They're just vast open spaces where these plants once existed. Most of them voted, according to the old UAW people, most of them voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries. But then in the general election, they voted for Trump because they weren't going to vote for Clinton, who gave them NAFTA, who destroyed their families, their lives, their city, their ability to make a sustainable income. And yes, Trump caters to that racism and nativism and xenophobia and Islamophobia, but that's what happens when societies begin to disintegrate. So I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, and with the economic collapse of Yugoslavia in the late 1980s, you vomited up Trump-like figures, Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic, Franjo Tuđman, who blamed the social deterioration on the other. In this case, it would have been the other opposing ethnic group. It's not rational, but it works. It's what worked in Weimar Germany, although Jews were about 1% of the German population. So this is a very common consequence of a society in the grip of very morbid pathologies. We're hardly unique. And let's say we do get another economic collapse, as many are predicting, you can expect that kind of demonization of the vulnerable, especially in the hands of Trump and those around him, Stephen Miller and others, to become far more pronounced. And I think there's a credible argument that he already flirts with inciting violence. I think that will become quite overt.
Well, you know, as a bulwark against the rise of right-wing groups, traditionally you would have labor unions, or you would have churches that were moderate or liberal, or you would have, you know, maybe a left-wing organization out there. It seems that, at least when it comes to the questions about immigration or building the wall, President Trump is winning. He's got a score of wins. He's moving in that direction of more nationalism. Why so many victories for Trump? Even, you know, even if he only won by a narrow margin in three or four states.
Well, I think you put your finger on it, and that is, we don't have that bulwark. The press has been gobbled up, courtesy, again, of a Democratic administration, Bill Clinton, with the deregulation of the FCC by a handful of corporations, Clear Channel, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, etc. You have seen an assault, and this assault has continued with the so-called right-to-work laws, which will further diminish. Only about 6% of the American working force outside the public sector is even in a union, and a dismantling of the kinds of regulations that once protected workers, including, of course, in the EPA, from being poisoned by toxins. All of that's been taken from us. And I would argue that the voices of these people are not heard. They've been rendered by large corporate media enterprises such as CNN invisible because they love the reality show aspect of our political system, the kind of political theater, because it's profitable. It's a form of entertainment. It has nothing to do with news. I mean, long discussions about Stormy Daniels or Omarosa, I speak as an old newspaper guy, this is not news. It's trivia masquerading as news. And so what I fear is that, unlike the 1930s, when we had strong and, you know, diverse independent press, strong popular movements, the old CIO, one can't forget the Communist Party, which was an important social dynamic, the Progressive Party, a liberal class embodied around Roosevelt that was able to hear and address the social collapse, Roosevelt understanding that if the private sector could not create jobs, then it was his job to create jobs, which he did, 12 million jobs, Social Security, so people without pensions, elderly people were not being, literally there was malnutrition, even serious hunger on the part of many of the elderly in the 19th. All of these issues were addressed, and the corporate powers have been steadily dismantling whatever New Deal policies and the residue was. And then, as you pointed out, that bulwark, that ability we had to organize to protect our own interests, these have been taken from us. So you had economic collapse in Europe, economic collapse in the United States. We went one way to a form of democratic socialism under Roosevelt, but Europe went another way. And I fear that, you know, history may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. I can't remember who said that. That without that bulwark, without that ability to protect ourselves, we could cement into place a kind of variant of proto-fascism. It's different in terms of how it will manifest itself and how it will look. But our democratic system is very anemic, and it's virtually in elected officials. It's just a system of legalized bribery, in essence. The courts have been captured by corporate power, so you get rulings like Citizen United, where they are just stripping us of our basic constitutional rights by judicial fiat. So unlimited corporate money, dark money into campaigns is interpreted by the Supreme Court as a form of free speech or the right to petition the government. This is not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind when they wrote about free speech and the right to petition the government. The fact that we know because of the evidence provided by Edward Snowden that every citizen in this country is watched and monitored, and in that word, you know, that's the relationship of a master and a slave. I don't even know if you can use the word liberty. When your government monitors you 24 hours a day, your medical records, your emails, your phone calls, and, of course, we all conveniently carry tracking devices for them wherever we go, it's that combination of economic decline coupled with mechanisms of wholesale control is terrifying, because at a moment of serious unrest, or when the ruling corporate oligarchic elites feel threatened, they will use every tool at their disposal.
Chris, I know we said we'd go to 11:30. We're a little bit past it. Do you have a few more minutes? Or
sure.
Okay. Chris Hedges is our guest. He is a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School and a Pulitzer Prize-winning former journalist for the New York Times. He writes a weekly column for the website Truth Dig and hosts the Emmy-nominated show On Contact on RT America. He's an ordained Presbyterian minister. We're talking about his new book, America, the Farewell Tour. Let's talk about some of these right-wing groups that you looked at and that you talked with, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, groups like the Oath Keepers. Would you call them fascist? Would you call them right-wing? And where did they come from?
Yeah, I would call them fascist, or certainly they have strong fascistic tendencies. Where did they come from? They came from a disenfranchised white working class. They came from, especially among that disenfranchised class, young, primarily men, who realized there was no place for them within the system, who saw there was no place for their fathers and mothers within the system, who realized that the quote-unquote American dream was a lie, which it is, that social mobility is virtually non-existent for the working class, and in particular, the poor. And they desperately looked around for scapegoats, for those who they believed or believe are responsible for the decline of the country. And as all fascist groups do, they take it out on the other. So undocumented workers, I mean, the idea that undocumented workers are responsible for the economic decline of America is absurd, of course. Muslims, African Americans, there's a strong, I mean, these are white groups. They're not people of color. So that's where they came from. And again, they are a product of a diseased culture, which I think that is the whole point of the book, that when society sees up, when governments are unable to effectively respond to the rights and the grievances of the citizenry, when all of the institutions and centers of power are directed towards enriching a tiny cabal, whether that's an empowering, giving absolute power to a tiny cabal, whether that's fascist, communist, monarchical, or in our place, corporate, the system itself is no longer functions. The government, you can't carry out, as Karl Popper says, the incremental and piecemeal reform that is vital to sustaining a democracy. And then you create groups like this, whether it's people ingesting opioids just to go numb, whether it's hate groups, whether it's people who spin off into depraved activity like these BDSM cultists who I was with in San Francisco, preppers, survivalists, gamblers, people who just descend in economic distress into these casinos which are being built all around the country. The whole idea that gambling is a form of economic development, again, is symptomatic of an economy that doesn't work. And states, of course, are pushing it because they're trying to fill revenue shortfalls. So these white hate groups came out of a society that is in deep distress, and they are the natural consequence of what we've done.
Chris Hedges is our guest. The book is America, the Farewell Tour, and we have a ton of emails and a ton of phone calls. I just want to ask you one more question from my side, that is identity politics. People who are progressive and liberal and left spend a lot of time discussing identity politics as a way to try to solve the country's problems. What do you think about all the time that's spent on identity politics?
It's a waste of time. If it's divorced from economic justice, which it often is. So the idea of a woman CEO or an African-American president who works on behalf of Goldman Sachs, and I would argue there is no way within the American political system to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs, essentially are giving a diverse face to a rapacious, anti-democratic, and corrupt system. And I think the left has fallen for it. So diversity is obviously a good. We want voices that are not like our own. We want them empowered. We want them heard. But diversity without an understanding that that must come with an open society and with a real democracy and economic justice essentially becomes a subterfuge that corporations have exploited and used quite effectively to further their own interests at the expense of us.
So let me read some of these emails that have come in. David writes, I went on vacation in North Florida a few weeks ago. It was sad to see how depressed some of those small towns in that area are. Mayo, Florida was an especially sad place because so many small businesses were closed down for good. And yet those folks voted for Trump. It's very perplexing. Thanks for bringing Chris Hedges on today. Here in Florida, our governor is touting the fact that our economy has come back, and we have 67 counties here in Florida, but I think the number is something like 13 or 14 counties have not recovered from the Great Recession. The economic recovery is very uneven, and it's especially hit rural areas hard. We talked a little bit about this a moment ago, but what do you make of the fact, I mean, David's point that these people in rural areas voted for Trump? How could they be convinced? What do you think might be said to them to convince them that perhaps President Trump isn't working in their best interest?
Well, they've been betrayed by the Republicans, but even more so by the Democratic Party, which continues to pretend to care about and represent their interests. And so there's a very legitimate and understandable anger at the system. And you watched Trump during the campaign carry out this kind of crude invective and ridicule and demeaning language towards the elites, Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton. And it is expressing that rage, that anger. They don't trust these elites, nor should they. And so that's why you saw insurgencies in both parties. And however inept and narcissistic and corrupt Trump is, until the elites begin to address and respond in a real way to the suffering of these communities, at least Trump's ridicule is somehow cathartic. And my fear with the Democratic Party is that, which of course is an appendage of corporate power, they just are they're the side of corporate power that don't want to be identified as racist or misogynist, but there's no daylight between them and the Republicans on, we didn't even talk about empire, these endless wars in the Middle East, which are hollowing the country out from the inside, futile and can never be won, or the kind of embrace of corporate policies that are so disadvantageous to the rest of us. Blaming the rise of Trump on Russia or on Comey, or this is a way to skirt facing the issue. And the problem is that the Democratic leadership, Pelosi, Schumer, and the others, are creations of Wall Street, and should they enact serious campaign finance reform and open up the primaries, and if the primaries had been open, I think Sanders would clearly won, remove this corporate dark money from the political system, they wouldn't have political power. They are creations of this system, and that's why appealing to them to carry out serious reform both within the party and the economy is useless. And we have seen evidence of that since the elections, as they have purged progressives and Sanders supporters from the party.
Our guest is Chris Hedges. We're talking about his book, America, the Farewell Tour. Let's go to that question of the military. One of the bright spots in your depiction of Scranton, Pennsylvania, is the weapons factory there. It's working. It's employing people. What's your take on the role of the military right now? Do you think we're going to go? These are big questions. Do you think that President Trump is serious about going to war with Iran? And do you think? What do you think of this move this week? The idea floated that the war in Afghanistan would be privatized.
Well, I mean, going to war with Iran is. The Pentagon doesn't want it, first of all. I was the former Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, and was there for 7 years. So that would just ignite a Shiite uprising. That would be seen in the Middle East as a war on Shiism, and that would leech over 60% of Iraq is Shia, huge Shiite Bahrain, 3 million Shiites in Saudi Arabia. The consequences of that would be catastrophic. The only reason we're so far as I can tell, continuing the war in Afghanistan is because it's very good for the weapons manufacturers. The Taliban controls more territory than they did when we went in. Other than enriching these private contractors, and you mentioned Eric Prince, the war industry, these wars have been a disaster. They've been a disaster for everyone in the Middle East and a disaster for us. But again, you know, when a system's seized up, we don't really have a voice. We don't have any say. If it's good for profit, it's good for corporate profit, it's good for America, and wars, as it has been throughout history, is a really lucrative and good business. It distorts our own economy, as you pointed out. The only thing they make in Scranton are artillery shells, which get shipped over to places like Yemen or Afghanistan, explode, then they build new shells. It's not economically beneficial, but we don't make any. I mean, you want to make weapons because your cost overruns are covered. It's not capitalism. It's kind of corporate socialism. You can't lose. And then when you seek within, it distorts the domestic economy. So, for instance, when New York City wanted to buy new subway cars, nobody makes subway cars in America. Why? Make tanks. You're guaranteed to make a killing. So they had to buy their subway cars from Japan. That is the distortion of the economy, and gets to the point that you raised of how when you militarize a society, and of course the amount of money that we spend on the military, which when you count Veterans Affairs and all the attendant budgets is probably $1 trillion a year, and meanwhile our roads and bridges are crumbling, our public libraries are being closed, our schools are being closed and privatized, of course, because the Department of Education spends about $63 billion a year in education, and the hedge funds and, you know, all these vultures on Wall Street want it. And Betsy DeVos is working overtime to make sure they get it. So that late stage of capitalism, if you're a Marxist, is about the cannibalization of the very structures that make a democratic capitalism possible. And so everything becomes government, traditional government services, we talked earlier about Scranton, becomes privatized as a way to further bleed the citizenry. So 70% of our intelligence gathering is done by private corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, which makes 99% of its 99% of its budget comes from the U.S. government. That privatization of traditional governmental services is part of the predatory nature of late capitalism, but at the same time, it also weakens and destroys the superstructures that make a democratic system and a functioning government possible.
Chris Hedges is our guest, and our phone number is 813-239-9663. This is 88.5 FM. Let's go to a question from Dan, who's calling in from Seminole. Dan, what's your question for Chris Hedges?
Yeah, hey, Chris. Hey, I just wanted to see, why isn't there more outrage about something I just read yesterday about the fact that due to corporate or in stock buyback program, this is denied employees, like, say, McDonald's, $4,000 a year in potential pay raise. CVS could have been $18,000 a year. This sounds to me like it could be a great rallying point to cross lines because it affects everybody, affects their pocketbook. What do you think about that?
All right.
Well, I think you're right. And I think part of my frustration with the left is the way they have demonized Trump supporters, deplorables. I'm not defending their racism, and of course I don't like Trump, but their distress and their anger is real. It's not invented. And I think that we have to, as the caller correctly pointed out, get behind campaigns. I mean, for instance, if you went into a Walmart and said, look, I'm here to organize so everybody gets $15 or $20 an hour, whether you support Trump or don't, you're going to be behind it. And I think that we begin to have to address those basic economic and social justice issues. And we're going to have to work with people whose political views may be distasteful to us. I forget who it is, Lord Salisbury, somebody said, you know, there's no permanent allies, only permanent power. And those divisions, that writing off of Trump supporters as just ignorant yahoos, further empowers the corporate state. And so this is part of getting back to the whole problem of multiculturalism and diversity. These are cultural issues. They're not issues. I'm sympathetic to many of them, but it's not politics. It's really a form of anti-politics. And I think we have to recapture politics, which is about discussions of power and economic distribution and rights that affect all of us. Unfortunately, we're hampered by a commercial media that does not find that those discussions are revenue producing, at least not at the levels they want. And so we get endless interviews with former porn stars and our lawyer.
Well, here's a related question to that. Chip in Tampa writes, do you believe Russians interfered with the election, or is it a story created by the Democratic National Committee to distract from their interference in the Democratic primary?
I believe I have no evidence, but I would not be surprised if the Russians attempted to influence the elections that in a way that would be favorable to them, and I think they clearly saw Trump as favorable to them. But I don't think that it had any real effect on the outcome. And I would also add, as somebody who spent 20 years overseas, we interfere in elections all over the place, and not just in elections, but you can go back to the 1954 coup d'etat in Guatemala with Arbenz, the overthrow of Mossadegh, 1953 in Iran, Salvador Allende, the Bay of Pigs. There's a professor at Carnegie Mellon who said, in terms of interference of elections, hit by his count, it's 81, including an estimated $2.5 billion handed to the Chicago school's anointed Russian presidential candidate, Boris Yeltsin. So this is what governments do. I'm sure the Chinese did it. We know Israel does it. I mean, if you talk about foreign interference, nobody beats Israel. But that's not why we have Trump. And, of course, the Democratic Party does not want the focus to be on their complicity in the social inequality that has engendered the kind of deep inchoate rage that has gripped huge swaths of the American public.
Well, let's get a woman's voice on this. We're going to go to a caller, Lori in Summerfield. Lori, what's your question for Chris?
Well, actually, just a comment. First of all, I'm going to look forward to reading your book as a librarian. I like to read. But basically, all the points you're making are, of course, spot on. I just wanted to comment, too. You mentioned, you know, these wars and that to send people off and just the whole mechanism. It draws people back. It just kind of feeds the system. In other words, you're out to war, you get injured, you come back. Now you're disabled, you need medicine. You're in the country, you're out of work, you're getting stressed, you need pharmaceuticals. It's kind of like a trap laid. Like I think you said something where they're set up and you don't even know. You're being puppeted in a sense. And it honestly, it really disheartens me about the whole voting system when you can see that ones are getting pardoned for things that are just so blatant. You just really kind of have a lack of faith that even the voting process is legit.
All right, Lori, thanks. Thanks for your comment.
Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks. Chris, you want to comment about...
Well, I share all of those sentiments. And, I mean, she's right to put her finger on the opioids, because why did all of these insurance companies push a pain medicine? Because they didn't want to pay for physical therapy. They just, even if their clients ended up becoming addicted, it was cheaper. And she's also right about what happens to these veterans who come back, who are pulled from a particular economic class. People who are deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan are not coming from every segment of society. They're coming from the lower economic strata of society. And once they're done, they're kind of cast aside. That is just part of the kind of tragic cruelty of a state where that it looks at everything, including its citizenry, as commodities that it can exploit until exhaustion or collapse. And we haven't even spoken about climate change. But again, it's that short-term profit by extracting coal or tar sands or fossil fuels, when we know that at this point the consequences, if we don't stop doing it in a big way, will mean the potential extinction of the human species.
Let's go to a call from George in Ybor City. George, you're on the air with Chris Hedges on WMNF.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on your characterization of Afghanistan as a little bit too simplistic about it's simply about contractors making money for weapons. The real story is that the Taliban to Afghanistan are like the cartels to Mexico. If you go in there and really clean the place up, the government will fall apart. Mexico would fall apart if we wiped out those cartels. The Taliban are supported by Pakistan. That's the only reason they exist, is Pakistan. And if we went in there and really clamped down, Pakistan would fall apart. And we can't let that happen because they have nuclear weapons and there'd be a war with India. So we're really there, over there, just kind of treading water, keeping the Taliban busybody. So we have to decide, do we want to just pull out and let it go and let it be like it was before 9/11, where they just beat up women? The Taliban are happy to stay there and just
all
beat
right
up women.
And George, we're almost out of time, so let's get Chris's answer. Thanks a lot, George. All right, Chris, you, as the old war correspondent you are.
Yeah, and I covered the Middle East. I mean, yeah, I'm fully aware of, I mean, the Taliban is a creation of Pakistan and the ISI. I'm fully aware of that. Pakistan promoted the Taliban because it saw it as a kind of, they knew the Taliban would be always hostile to India, and that Pakistan's focus is on India. The Taliban had wiped out poppy production, and then with the war, resurrected it because it's a huge source of their income. So, I mean, he's right that they function as a cartel, but they weren't functioning as at least a drug cartel before we went in. I'm not pretending that it won't be a mess when we leave, but in many ways it's a mess we created. And there is just no exit. There is just no way out. We're not going to win this war. Whatever we do, it's going to be dirty and messy. But prolonging it is not helpful to Afghanistan, not helpful to us, and not helpful to the region.
Chris, we just have 30 seconds, but do you think it's inevitable that the U.S. slides further into a decline of the middle class, growing lower classes, and we create what you call these sacrifice zones in one of your previous books, that it gets worse? Do you think the situation just gets worse?
Yes, and I think that we have to respond to the new economic configuration so that maybe we live with less. But we take care of our own. And we haven't even mentioned the day the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency. We know what that means economically. We saw the 1950s when the pound sterling was dropped as the world's reserves currency. At that moment, your economy goes into free fall. And we're all pretending that America will be great again. We're not dealing with the reality around us, which will make the shock and the dislocation. And again, you know, which is the focus of the book, the kinds of attendant pathologies that come with it worse.
Well, Chris Hedges, thanks a lot. Maybe we could have you back or bring you to town and give a speech. But it's a great book, America, The Farewell Tour. Chris Hedges is the author. Chris, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thanks for having me.
All right, thanks. That's Chris Hedges. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, used to work for the New York Times. He's also a host on RT America, and he writes a column for Truth Dig. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up, 813-238-8001, and you can record on that line your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Daniel Ruth is coming up next with his Midpoint program. And thanks to Amika Thomas, she was our phone producer today. Have a great weekend. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. I'm Rob Lori. Stay tuned for the latest news from NPR. And then right after that, Daniel Ruth, the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the Tampa.